come in and sit with us. We're four friends, talking, thinking, and laughing. We take on the absurd and the profound, sometimes both at once.
And we speak about aging because, oh, yes, we're living it, feeling it in our bones. First time for all of us.
And we don't plan to go quiet. We prod, we tease, we wander down strange roads. A story here, an argument there, a joke, maybe a truth.
Dylan Thomas said it best, "Do not go gentle into that good night." We won't. We'll burn, we'll rage, we'll keep moving. We'll take care of each other as we go.
Hi, welcome to Seniors in the Building. I'm Signe.
I'm Jack.
I'm Elaine.
And I'm Rick. So actually, one of the insights that came to me, I thought about this a little bit, about fear and anxiety, is I find when things are uncertain or things are left unaddressed, that causes me quite a bit of anxiety and fear. So for example, if there's something looming on the horizon, even if I do a little bit to, say, prepare, schedule, deal with it, even if I don't, say it's a problem, I don't resolve it, right away that reduces my sense that things are out of control, you know, that things are manageable. So I guess for me, and that ties in with that joke about my behavior, that I need a schedule, right? Well, yeah. part of the reason for that, it gives some structure then, so I sort of have a sense of where I'm going. It's not all so chaotic. So that's one thing that I find really helps, you know, reduce my fear or anxiety when I'm dealing with stuff. And I find, again, talked about this other times, as you get older, we have sort of a less of a sense of control sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, more, whether it's about health, whether it's about, you know, where we're going to live, whether it's about how much agency we have. So I think that's a challenge for us. So.
I really identify with that. I think that I also have this sense of, as things are coming at me, I like to be, Jack can attest to this, be ready for them. I like to know the details, and I like to know how everybody thinks it's going to go down, and so that I can prepare and have things ready. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, you know, house things that we still have to do, and those I anticipate and try to be in front of. But I identify with that, sort of, if I work on it every little bit, it always feels like a little step forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it does reduce my anxiety. Mm-hmm.
I think that's why I make lists. I list what are my tasks for the day. I make a grocery list. I make a list, and I call it a list, even though Rick will call it a schedule, but I will list. I need to pick up the kids from school. Mm-hmm. I need to go to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I need to get to Home Depot, whatever. I just list those things down and list direct my life. I think that also speaks to your anxieties over schedule, because I can get distracted easily and go off in another direction, and that messes with the schedule, or it messes
with the plan
for the day or whatever, right? And yeah. So I have to hear your schedule so that I can set my list and try to make sure I'm not creating more anxiety in the household than is absolutely necessary. But I also think another piece of that is, now that we're retired, the routine is not there.
Right.
Couldn't get up and I find that, you know, the morning, the dog is giving me some routine at 7 a.m., but I don't have the same routine, right? And so some day mornings I wake up and I wonder, where am I going? What am I doing? What's up today? And so that is a bit of
that can
anxiousness
create,
created there.
So that creates anxiety. It certainly does for me, too. But now that I go every morning to help the kids, then I get up at a certain time, and I'm out of the house by a certain time, and then I'm walking, which is an amazing way to deal with anxiety. So I love those early walks to my daughter's house. It's about a kilometer, and then walking back when she gets back. It's it's my time and it's time being physical. And that is really, I used to run to cope a lot when I was working. And when I go to the gym, I still run, but it's not for the extended period of time that I used to run. So running and walking really helped me to cope a lot.
Used to be a joke in the family when the boys were young and they would come home from school and Rick would come home from work and he would be just flitting everywhere, sort of not really settled, kind of, you know, and then somebody would say, yell at him and say, "Go for a run, Dad. Get out of the house." And so the three boys and I would kick him out for a run.
That's right, yeah. That's where
grounded.
How my running career started.
That's okay.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's good. It's a stress release, but it also helps, I think, reframe. And also, I mean, biologically, it releases some, I guess, good chemicals that help deal with some of the stresses that are there. So, yeah. Jack, you know?
Are we talking about what causes us stress or resolutions too?
Yeah, I was more on resolutions, but it could be causes too. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Life causes me stress.
Yeah.
No, but in terms of schedules, I was thinking I used to. Retirement meant I came out from under the burden of schedules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to remember when my classes were, had to prep for them, had all the faculty meetings and committee meetings of all sorts.
Yeah.
And that was oppressive. And now there's no schedule. And I relish not having a schedule.
Mm.
And I don't think I need one because my life is rather simplified.
Yeah.
Mm. I get up, I have breakfast, I do my Spanish, which was great this morning, and I play guitar if there's time, and there's no agenda.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
None.
Yeah.
But there's some sort of, not necessarily tightly scheduled, but sounds like there's some programmed activities that you enjoy doing that you engage in. So your day, your morning isn't just sort of aimlessly wandering around.
Well, even if it is, that's okay.
That's okay.
And that's relaxing.
Yeah. Hmm.
So it can be often aimlessly wandering around.
Yeah.
Like deciding in the morning, maybe I'll drive out to Selkirk.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Other than when there's a blizzard.
Yes, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Well, I wonder if, I mean, we're not going to dwell on causes, but I wonder if that's part of my issues. After so many years, and even before I started working, feeling you need to be productive,
mm-hmm.
I think that some of that feeds into the sense maybe of anxiety is that somehow, for me anyways, not productive, you know, can't just sit around, got to be busy doing something. And I know that's not healthy, but I think that's where... We talked last time, or we talked at one time about reframing, and I think that's something that needs to take place, and I'm still working on. So,
I think I'm almost the opposite, right? I'm like an Energizer bunny, trying to get this thing, different things done, and then I like slam up against a wall and say, "Poof, I've got to sit down and recoup again and reframe my head," or whatever you know, like using mm-hmm. that language that you're talking about. So then, yeah, finding myself a settling down moment, you know, doing something quietly, right? And for me, that's usually reading. I can read many books, you know, a few hundred books a year, just because I'm mm-hmm. the quietness, the mind has to settle down and can be no disruptions and, you know, so almost the opposite.
And that's interesting, the sort of not having structure, trying to create structure, and what needs to be in that structure in order to feel
mm-hmm.
less stressed, but also that you are, well, doing something or completing something. Or, yeah, I feel that strongly too. I've got to get some things done,
mm-hmm.
Or I have wasted my day. And
yeah.
Jack doesn't have that kind of pressure at all in his head.
Mm-hmm.
I have it in my head.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to coordinate.
Yeah, and you all, Jack, you also find time for meditation, right?
At night, I do.
Yeah, at night you do? Okay.
Like, to speak about that generically, it's more finding grounding somewhere to disengage from the anxiety.
Okay.
And something as simple as following your breath, noticing your breathing in and out. And that's foundational to the Hindu, not just Hindu, but Buddhist as well, pranayama, which is the study of breathing. Prana is breath. So pranayama is, you know, thousands of years old science of breathing. And it takes you out of your head and into your body. And then there's body scan as well, which is just noting various parts of your body systematically, which takes you out of your head. So anything that can take you out of your head is good, since, you know. Plus, I think psychologically, every one of us has a pusher. A pusher.
Okay.
It has been put there by parents, by our vocations, by our society generally, to push, push, push. The achievement pusher.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And that's why I don't make lists, because that just, mind you, making the list can take the pusher out of your head and put it on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And then I would burn it if I made lists.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
I don't burn them, but I throw them away.
Yeah.
And part
there
of
you
it
go.
Is because of some ADHD has like qualities or whatever.
Yeah.
I can easily be distracted onto something else. So the list actually lessens my anxiety, but it also reminds me that there are some tasks that I like to get done today. And again, you're right, it's a pusher thing.
Yeah.
It's a eldest child thing. I know that was taught to me, and then I push that on to my siblings, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
and your kids?
And my kids, and my grandkids. I'm not so sure I do it so much with the grandkids. I'm just, feel like I'm just a cheerleader more than anything. But yeah, you're right, that pusher mentality from society. Also, my gender, you know, being feminine or, you know, female, society expects greater things. You know, three times the amount of things that a guy can do, right?
To get to the same place.
To get to the same place, right?
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
The lists aren't necessarily saying, oh, I can cross it off, because people have told me that before too. Oh, I'll write down your list and then check them off, and then you won't be so distracted. I don't even bother half the time crossing it off, as long as it's on that list and I haven't distracted myself too much from it.
Does it you say distracted, but does it help keep you focused? Because that's what lists do for me. They help keep me focused on what I was gonna do today instead of flitting off to do something else.
Yeah.
And being distracted.
And sometimes it's done so that you actually put some pleasure into your life too, right? I mean,
exactly.
It's not just about the household tasks or the taking care of the family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a focus.
The few meditation retreats I've been on, you do absolutely nothing but sit and breathe.
Uh-huh.
And I find that so boring.
have to really adapt to that. Yeah.
That's so
Well, and you follow your breath in and out, and there's no more to it.
No.
I know.
That's it.
Yeah.
And after 6-7 hours,
wow.
I'm thinking of the Zen retreat I went to in India. After 6-7 hours, you get up off your stool. I mean, you can get up any time, of course. It's not regimented.
Oh, okay.
But for most people, just sit and breathe.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
And it is amazing. I remember getting up after a couple days. And you eat, too. You go for lunch and for supper. But you're up at 4 in the morning.
Hmm.
Or 5, I can't remember. when it was all over, I went for a walk outside, and I have never seen such beautiful scenery and colors in my life. So my capacity for sensory receptivity was so enhanced by just being quiet and breathing for those hours upon hours.
So this was a structured retreat or a scheduled
retreat? Yeah, there
retreat
were about
20 to?
People,
okay.
A bunch from Germany,
yeah.
A couple of psychiatrist professors were there. They came from Germany for it, as well as a number of other people. And I sat on a stool that a good friend made for me, a meditation stool. Now, I was thinking about that this morning. The sad part is I can't sit on that stool anymore. You put your feet underneath it.
Okay.
Right.
And so you're basically sitting on the back of your feet, though you're not, because the stool is there.
Yeah.
But I just can't sit that way anymore.
And it's on a bit of a slant.
It's on a bit of a slant, yeah.
Oh, so it has to be a specific kind of design.
Yeah, well, it was made after the one I guess I used in India.
Okay.
I took the dimensions of it.
Yeah. And, so, but you went there that one time. Have you tried that again? Or I'm curious.
No.
Yeah.
Well, it was arduous getting there from Bangalore.
Oh, yeah.
But there's the retreats all over. There's Vipassana, which is worldwide. But those are, I forget how long, 20 days or something like that. And they're very rigorous.
Mm. Yeah.
And they scared me off. Though I was signed up for one in India, I never went.
Yeah, 20 days is quite
so this
a
was only 5 days, right. For example, yeah. Uh-huh. Or are they
five
10 days?
5 days was long enough to learn how to breathe.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. yeah, I know. Uh-huh.
You know what? Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was thinking about during the pandemic, and we read up on the Japanese practice of forest bath.
Right.
Forest bathing.
Yeah.
And that's really what got us started on getting to 21 parks in the city of Winnipeg, right? Because we decided we would go to these forested areas and just walk and walk and walk. And we hardly said a word to each other as we walked. But it's so true, right? Because you begin, as your experience was, you begin to notice the world around you, and it's not so much in your head as it is a sensory experience of using your eyes, you know, and your ears to sort of see and hear.
Yeah, so metaphorically,
what's around you?
Metaphorically, the world is breathing around you.
Mm. Oh, that is beautiful.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, I like
the birds. I used to lay down near the Grand River in the spring when the ground dried out. Just lay in the bush, because it was a bush I wasn't familiar with coming from Alberta and then Winnipeg. It was so, the trees were huge and the variety was so immense.
Yes.
Compared to other places I'd been. And just lay there and listen to the wind and the birds and the trees.
Yep.
Yeah, forest bathing.
Mm. I love trees. I love trees. I have always loved trees, and it has been I've always tried to go places like the Redwood Forest.
Yes.
And places where the trees are amazing and magnificent and storied and historical. And Olive Grove. I have never been to an Olive Grove, and that's one thing I want to get to someday in my life. There's a very old one in Spain, the oldest one in the world, that is still producing olive oil.
Olives, yeah.
Uh-huh. And olives, yeah.
Yeah,
and
wow.
I'd like to go there.
Yeah.
Plan that.
Well, you know, when you talk about sort of that forest bathing, I mean, that's one of the things I look forward to in the winter when I go cross-country skiing. Like, I was able to go out yesterday, and just because most of the trails go through forested areas and sheltered areas,
yeah.
the routes I go on. And the physical activity helps, but I find just being in among those trees among the forest is remarkable. You know, you come out of there and you just feel more alive. So I know some people structure things in. You structure in the breathing. I tend not to as much, except for regular exercise. But maybe that's something we need to recapture a bit, you know, because like you said, during the pandemic, we used to do a lot of that. And now we tend not to again.
Right. although I will admit that I walk the elliptical machine only if I have the pictures of the forest.
Oh,
have you seen those at the reef?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they do the whole, you can do a trail in Germany,
you can walk along,
right? And the drone gives you the pathway and everything. And that's the only way I'll get on that elliptical machine.
I would do that too.
I know, yeah, because the forest is, you're right in the forest.
Exactly. When I was running more outside, that's exactly what it was, especially when I'd go visit my mom, because she lived by a rail in the U.S., and maybe in Canada, too, they do rails to trails when the railway isn't
being
don't do it as much as they should, but yeah, same thing.
Isn't being used as much or used anymore. They take off all the railroad ties and then pave it so that it is a trail.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful because it was behind my mom's house and it was through the, and she lives in Michigan, and so it's all of these hardwoods and pines and beautiful, beautiful trees. And I loved running there.
Yeah.
I loved running there a lot. I have lots of pictures of it.
I think there's an irony in terms of what we've been talking about, and that is scheduling relaxation. It's like in meditation, the harder you try, the more you fail.
Oh.
You can't try to breathe.
You just gotta let it go.
It will happen. Uh-huh. So just like going into the forest and having a trail that you want to get from A to B on is kind of self-defeating. Because again, the pusher is there to finish from A to B rather than just B. And that brings to mind something one of my teachers in India said in terms of learning Sanskrit or Hindi, which Hindi is a derivation of Sanskrit, is that in Indian thinking, the verb to be is more important than to do. But in the Western world, the to-do is oppressively dominant. And we just don't know how to be, I think. I mean, that's a blanket statement, but because we've been ingrained with these pushers coming to us from our parents in particular. I blame my parents, but every parent does that. We've done it with our kids. Go get this, do that, be self-sufficient. You got to make a salary, and support yourself. And I still find myself doing it at times with the kids, which is pathetic.
They're always your kids.
Yeah,
they're always
your
kids.
Yeah, they're always your kids. No matter what.
One of the thoughts that crosses my mind then is when you say that to be is more important. I'm not disagreeing, but it sort of goes to this whole sense of identity, which we talk about. You know, who are we? And often, I'm agreeing with you, Jack. In our Western culture, we identify who we are, our place, our value, our purpose, by what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
And not by just being and who we are. And that's, I mean, that's really unfortunate. And I think maybe that's also why many of us elders, seniors, struggle, because all of a sudden, a lot of our sense of who we are, which is tied up with our profession, our is taken away, or we've moved out of that willingly or unwillingly, and then we go, well, now who am I? Now,
exactly.
Yeah. Now what am I? And so there's a huge reframing that needs to happen.
When we came back from that year that we lived in India with the kids, I somehow had picked up, and I'm not sure where, I guess I'd have to think about it, maybe it's in my journals, this mantra that I started to use when I came back to Canada is that I am enough. I am enough. And I haven't used it in the last few years so much, but that was something that I, when I got back, it became a part of me. It became a sense of, okay, I'm doing the best I can, I'm enough in this situation. I don't have to be any more than I am. And that's enough for now. And I will continue to, learn and grow, but I can't be something that I'm not in this moment. And I think it was that mindfulness probably that we were introduced to when we lived there that gave me that.
Mm-hmm.
And it served me well, but I haven't used it in a few years. But it's really appropriate for right now,
mm-hmm.
too, in that sense of I am enough, and I am, and what does unpack that? What does that mean? And just really think about who and what I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of food for thought for me.
Yeah, who we are right now. I sat in on a conversation one time with an indigenous elder, with other groups of people in part of the group, right? And I recall when they introduced themselves, they said, "My name is, and I am the child of, and I grew up in," I can't remember the whole process, but anyway, they identified themselves with who they were connected to. Yeah, their lineage, the land that they came from. And not once in all of the conversation did I hear, "I'm a doctor."
Interesting, yeah.
Right? All I heard was that who they were was the lineage that had been created and connected them to a community, a people, a tribe, whatever, and that they were connected to the land. And for me, that was an eye-opener, because I had grown up in a family with an alcoholic. And when I was 18 years old, I left home. I hightailed it out there as fast as I could and detached myself from that particular aspect of that family, right? And so when I was sitting in this, listening to this elder, it just sort of hit me that I would never be able to run away from that lineage. And I had to reframe that and think about.
Interesting.
And in fact, in some ways, that helped me to begin to understand that I am worthy, I am enough, I am, even though there were these aspects of the life that we had, which was a struggle, which was traumatic or whatever. And that helped me too, like when you think about what's the mantra in your life that sort of draws you in. And I really appreciated how that elder focused us on that.
That's really interesting too, you know, isn't it? Because it allows, if I think about it for myself, it allows me to accept and again, sort of reframe that origin, that piece that I came from, and hold it up as something that is part of me and yet doesn't totally define me.
Right, that's a good way to put it too. I think the other piece of that is that as a retiree, I don't have to worry about when I'm in, to name my former occupation.
Right.
I can talk about who I am now via my lineage and the land I come from and the people that I'm connected to, right? And I think
that
releases me from that push of trying to identify myself as a former clergy, right? Or a, you know, I was this once upon a time, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to know what I was. It's not that I'm trying to avoid what I was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finally seeing that in my retirement years, I also still have something there that defines me differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And uniquely.
Yeah. And uniquely.
I guess I was thinking, like, tying in that phrase, "I am enough," it kind of helps us push against and maybe also go along with a lot of these expectations that have been put upon us or that we carry within us. Some of that, you use the word pushers, Jack, that,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it this helps us, I think, push against some of those expectations, or whether you want to call it perfectionism or the idea that we need to be somehow productive, or that somehow we need to be valued based on what we produce and what we have accomplished, but rather just sit in who we are and feel that's, and sometimes when those expectations kind of pile in on us, to just say, "Well, no, I'm okay. That's enough." I think that can help reduce some of the anxiety.
And the fear we have of where who we are now and where are we going and are we enough, and you know, as a retired people, mm-hmm. you know. Even using that language actually is kind of weird, right? Because you still are connected to who you were when you say, oh, I'm retired for.
Exactly.
Isn't that a weird?
Yes, it just, I'm retired from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's yeah. We'll have to think about that, right?
I know, yeah.
Because we don't
say,
I've retired from being Rick Sauer, right? I am still him, yeah.
I know. Yeah.
We don't say that, but somehow we feel like we've chopped off a part of our life, which isn't the case.
Yeah. My goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Isn't that the truth?
You know, as the years pass, how many years since I've been retired now? 10?
I have
must
been,
be going on
yes,
10.
Yes, 10. Uh-huh. Yes.
I don't even think of myself as a retired professor anymore.
Okay.
And not because it was bad or anything. I just don't. Hmm. And that's okay. I think about breathing.
that's important.
But
yeah.
In my best moments, in terms of the posts that I do on Instagram and Facebook, I try to say to myself who I am, mm-hmm. because that's a complex issue. And so I jettison in my own mind, former professor, though I relate to a lot of people and friends from that time remotely. But who I am, where I find resources that are inspiring for me there is cosmology. Mm. You know, we are self-conscious creatures on this planet, and that is enough. Mm. Like, that's a miracle, as far as we know.
Yeah.
Self-conscious creatures like us, bipedal or who knows how many legs or arms, don't exist on any other planet that we can see. And we're very limited in what we can see, but we are unique here. Mm-hmm. And every life should be valued by virtue of that, mm-hmm. because it's a miracle of the evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's really significant, because often we underestimate the significance of our existence, mm-hmm. the uniqueness, and the value we have just by being. I think that's a really good insight, mm-hmm. and a really good. I don't know, what's the word, mindfulness practice? I don't know if you'd use that mindfulness, you know?
Yeah. Mindfulness is a good generic designation for all sorts of contemplative practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the one that I wanted to raise that has been valuable to me, and I remember this morning, I've forgotten. Mm-hmm. And that was Julia Cameron's not so little book, but powerful book called The Artist's Way. And in there, she has as a fundamental exercise what she calls morning pages. You wake up in the morning, or you can do it actually any time during the day, and you write down verbatim what is going on in your head, what you're thinking. And if you can do that, and I did it for years, and then you step back after the fact, after what you've written, two or three pages, and read it, and you go, I think I'm insane.
Well, that's helpful.
No, it shows, it shows the chaos that goes on in our heads. And that's the insight that Hinduism and Buddhism brings, I think, and other mm-hmm. contemplative practices, is that the enemy, if we were to label it as an enemy, is our mind.
Mm. Yeah.
And so the Bhagavad Gita in the Hindu tradition shows over and over again, metaphorically or literally, how it is that our mind is like we're in a chariot, and we're out of control with our horses. They are just going destructively, madly ahead. And so Krishna teaches how to pull the reins back. Mm. And yoga, of course, various forms of yoga, are the ways of controlling it. Mm. And just put morning pages down, verbatim, unedited, what you're thinking, as you think it, and you'll look at it later and go, wow, out of control.
But and that may be your case.
Yeah, I was thinking, how am I going to do that?
I don't deny it's not my case.
I was just a very good friend of mine died a year and a half ago, and her husband, who was also a friend of mine, I went to actually, I knew her from when I was a little girl. So we grew up together. Anyway, she had been part of a, and then she married somebody that we all went to high school with and lived out west. But she had been part of a women's writing group for several years. And they, her husband found some of her notebooks and gave them to the writing group, who then published some of them in a book. And he sent it to me, and I was reading it again the other day, and it was amazing how much of my friend came through, even as she was dying. She was writing about things that were so consistent to who she was when I knew her as a little girl, and we, you know, went through school together. And I think some of her writing that was in there was also the same. It was just, they had to write something, and so she just put whatever she wanted to on paper. And when they published that, there were just so many interesting clues there to what she was thinking, and it made sense. It made sense to me. Partially because I knew her, but also because I'm not sure that it's chaos. I really wonder if it's more of a sort of putting on paper and seeing something, and then you can start to make sense of something. Do you know what I mean? If you've got it in front of you instead of roaming around in your head, you could start to move it around or start to flesh it out or start to look at what's in your head or what's going on with you differently. And that's also a way to deal, I think, with anxiety, is to get it out. Get out everything, and this is what I sometimes do, get everything out on a paper that's bothering me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then start to move it around.
That's right, yeah, because in the early days of after my parents died, I wouldn't say earliest days, but within 5 years, I was seeing a therapist, and that's exactly how we worked through some of my grief and my fear and my trauma, was I had to write things down, and then when I'd go in, she'd say, can you read a piece of your writing this week, right? What do you think you want to share today? And that stuff would come out. And even when I look at it, I'd say to myself, oh, she's going to just shake her head at this statement that came out of my head that day. But it was really amazing. It was such a release, you know. My issue is I can't keep at it, right? There's just something about the journaling, I pick it up every so often
for sure
and write in it, but I'm not one of those people who can write journal after journal, writing every single day, but it is really, it releases who you are. It truly releases who you are. And your
Cameron
feelings.
Distinguishes between writing and morning pages.
Oh, okay.
Morning pages is not writing.
No.
Morning pages is putting down what you're thinking from one disjointed thought to another.
I think
without editing, that's the trick.
Yeah, exactly.
No editing allowed.
Yeah. Oh, that would be hard for me.
Just put down what's there.
But the question I have then is, you look at it later, and does she say then maybe over a course of a month, if you put it all together? I'm wondering if there then maybe some kind of a pattern emerges, more like what Signe says?
Or definitely be patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Because they say something like, 90% of what we think in any particular day is repeated from the day before.
Obsessive in our thinking.
I know.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think that way, even if you took my pattern, what's up with my kids today? You know, I try to anticipate.
You know the themes.
Yeah, I know the themes.
You played them well.
Exactly, yeah.
And the point that Eastern traditions make is that we are not our thoughts. We're not our thoughts.
And
that is just blows my mind.
Well, because you think about fears.
I live in my head of thoughts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
But I'm not my thoughts.
Yeah.
And that's where the meditation practice, and I think maybe generically, all contemplative practices do that.
Yeah.
I mean, when you pray, mm-hmm. prayer is an externalizing of deepest desires
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
that lay subliminal beneath the conscious self often.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
I don't know. I don't pray, so I shouldn't talk about it.
I would agree. I think that's also why, for many people in say Western society, the allure of contemplative life, or you think of monasteries, monks. I know we associate it very much with a certain organization or institution, but why it had some sense of attractiveness, because it gave people opportunity from the regular stresses, fears, griefs of life to be able to not retreat from that, but have a different approach to it. Yeah. And I think
absolutely.
That's why it's appealing through the generations. So.
And don't we think that way about as we're looking at our sort of plan for the future from work, you know, our vocational time to retirement time, are we not also thinking about that? I've got to simplify my life. I've got to, you know, find a contemplative way to bring down my anxiety about work and schedules and all of that. It just fits so much in our thinking, right?
I wonder if retirement. Just like these two psychologists that I followed for years, Hal and Sid Rostone, said, we're constituted by many selves. There's the pusher self.
Mm-hmm.
There's the inner critic self.
Mm-hmm.
There's the deceit self, deceiver. We hide things from ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. I think they've got 10 or 12. I wonder if a society at large could be characterized by the dominance of one or more of those selves.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, it's the pusher
right.
and the inner critic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the critic has a function. It's there to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
That was put there by our parents. You know, watch out for this, watch out for that, don't do this, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've internalized it, of course, but it's there for a reason, so that we don't step in front of a bus. Right?
Did they have any fun selves?
Yeah, I was wondering too about
that. Yeah, humorous self.
There is a humor self? Okay, good.
But humor requires detachment from those pusher and inner critic to some degree.
And so humor, for me, humor, when I remember, is also a way of coping and reframing it and making mm-hmm. the absurdity of something.
Yeah,
to
laughter, right? Mm-hmm. And joy. I guess the joy is another one of those, right? How do I be a joy-filled person, right? How is that joyful self? And that's looking around and saying, I'm grateful. I've got gratitude for. These are the things that I give thanks for. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So those selves are wide and expansive, and I would even say unlimited, right?
Yeah, the gratitude self, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
I bought a calendar, or Signe gave it to me after I chose it. A calendar, it's called gratitude, and every day there's a reminder of something to be grateful for.
Uh-huh.
And when you think about it, when I think about it, there is no end to what to be grateful for.
Yeah.
For example, that I can breathe in,
mm-hmm.
and breathe out.
Yeah,
I need to be grateful for.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
because not everybody can.
Yeah.
And near the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about that time is limited for us as human beings, right? Because we are aging, and I think time. Every single day, I am grateful for the next day when I wake up in the morning and I say, "I've got one more day beyond what I had thought." I had, right? Or would have.
And that dissipates fear and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically. If we can,
this is all theoretical.
If we can focus on the breath in and out.
Yeah.
But isn't that part of who we are as seniors, right? In the building in some ways, right? That we are anxious about our future.
Yes. I came here thinking, well, I've been thinking about it ever since we were talking about this topic, is that I am fearful of the future because I am aging.
Yeah.
And how it will play out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're not alone.
Yeah.
And I think we...
You're not alone.
We all feel that way.
Well, it's hard to accept the fact that we're here for just the blink of an eye time.
No. Mm-hmm.
Just the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
And that is both scary, but it also ought to, I don't know, you know, I don't like the word ought or need anymore. Mm-hmm. Like ought and need, those are demanding words. Mm-hmm. But every moment is a gift. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, while we were talking, a couple text messages came in. Raise my anxiety about stuff I need to do. I'm going, okay, yeah.
Okay, let's wrap this up.
Let's wrap this up right now. More like, okay, let's don't worry about that. Let's focus on reducing the anxiety instead of the tasks ahead. But
aren't you glad we had this conversation?
I did, yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
No, I was just thinking sort of what Jack was saying too about you know, what was that one counselor years ago at one group said? We should not shoot on ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's a good phrase. Yeah. That was a
good phrase.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
good.
I think we are good for today. Yeah. Right. Our anxiety is lessened. Our fear is managed. Thank you for listening today.
Wow. Thanks for joining us today. You can find us under Seniors in the Building on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, RSS Feed Community, and possibly wherever you listen to other podcasts. Our email is forseniorsinthebuilding@gmail.com. That's the numeral 4, followed by seniorsinthebuilding, lowercase, all one word. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, stay curious and hopeful.